That is the sound of a routine west wind racing across the roof of the most famous new building in the world. And this sound, coming from 500 feet below, is a truck climbing up from the third basement of the same building, bound for a pier with tons of documents for an important meeting across the Atlantic. And between the noisy third basement and the windy roof of this structure is a self-contained city of 3,500 modern cliff dwellers, known officially as the Secretariat of the United Nations. This broadcast is about them and their work, and the vast slab of steel and glass and marble that they work in. An office home of 5,400 bluish-green windows whose function it is to let in light and, at the same time, to look out on the world.
United Nations Radio, in association with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents Douglas Fairbanks as narrator in Windows on the World, a special broadcast produced by Norman Corwin to celebrate the opening in Paris this week of the 6th General Assembly of the United Nations. Persons heard on the program were recorded at work in the Secretariat building of the United Nations headquarters in New York, and their voices are in every case authentic and unrehearsed.
The trouble with the Tower of Babel was that it had no air conditioning or simultaneous interpretation. And while the heat of Babylon was no worse than Manhattan in summer, or its winter cold no more frigid than Midtown in January, the fact remains that the Secretariat building, the new multilingual monolith at 42nd Street and the East River, is more comfortable, more durable, and more efficient than that old tower had any hope of being. Those of you who've never seen this building, and that means most of you, will be interested in what one of America's foremost critics of architecture had to say about it.
A building chaste, startling, fairy-like in its cold austerity. A snow queen's palace, exhaling by night a green moonlight splendor.
We quoted this description to a UN worker in the third basement, and he had this comment to make.
Look, I disagree with that. If you're working here, you'd have to really work. It's no laying down on your job. Yeah, everybody has to work, as far as I'm concerned.
This is Mr. Cook.
What do you mean, Cook? Cookie.
We chose Mr. Cook to start with because he's to be found at rock bottom, in the third basement, the logical place for our program to start climbing on a floor-by-floor ascent to the top. Mr. Cook, who drives one of the UN's six trucks, has strong feelings about the Secretariat building, and they're not entirely in accord with the critic's description of a fairy-like snow queen's palace.
No, I don't agree with it. I don't think it's anybody in here who looks like a fairy. My idea of fairy palace is when you see pictures. Nice pictures. Girls, beautiful girls all over the joint. You got nice cushions, nice lounges. Then that's a fairy paradise to me. But here it isn't no fairy paradise. You can see you got none but cases.
But what was that about a snow queen, you ask him?
I can't understand a snow queen unless the building's so clean on the outside and all and on the inside. Maybe that's what he means, a snow queen.
Then he likes the UN building.
The glass, the construction of it and all. Not a building in the world like it. Not a building like it, and I travel and I never saw any like it.
What does he think of the first 6 years of the United Nations organization?
They say the first 50 is the hardest. So 6 years, you can't do a lot in 6 years.
Does he think we're skating on thin ice?
I wouldn't even say thin ice. You're just skating on ice, and it won't break.
We thank Cookie for his views and look around the third basement. However lowly the floor, it leads a full, rich life of its own, with a ceaseless coming and going of documents and articles to and from the member nations. José Conte of the Diplomatic Pouch Unit, who hails from Guayaquil, Ecuador, tells us,
"We send these pouches to the different offices that the United Nations has overseas, such as information centers and the different commissions. We have information centers in London, Monrovia, New Delhi, Mexico, Rio, Copenhagen, and also we have these economic commissions in Latin America and in Bangkok, Thailand. And we also have these different commissions like the Palestine commissions, the Balkan commission, the Indonesian commission, in Korea, in Asmara, and in Mogadishu, that is in East Africa, in Somaliland.
Asmara, Mogadishu, Somaliland. Far-off exotic names to contend with. And contending with far-off names is exactly what these men have to do. Take Jimmy Linwood of Brooklyn, shipping department. We caught him in the act of contending with a label on a carton.
This one reads, Bellin Folgate, Samar Brett, Lila, my Gantan for Stockholm, Sweden. I don't know how my Swedish is. I don't think it's very good.
He tells us about UN workers going abroad on missions that have to do with such things as world health, with the care of children, and the resettlement of displaced persons, food for hungry populations, improving conditions of labor and industry, self-government for areas that have never enjoyed it in the past. But we remind ourselves that we're going to hear directly from people involved in these activities, people who work on the 40 floors still above us, and that we'd better start up if we're going to meet a fraction of their number. So we ring for one of the shiny aluminum-faced elevators, and it arrives with a ping. And it takes us to the second basement. Here, hard by one of the building's three garages, is a transportation office where UN cars are dispatched on all kinds of errands. We ask Tom Frawley of the Borough of Queens about the safety record of the UN drivers. How many miles have they driven? How many accidents?
I don't know offhand the number of miles. Well, this is a guess. I think it's 5 million miles, and I've never had really a fatal accident to speak of. And a lot of our insurance companies have sent us letters of appreciation and congratulations on our record.
Outside Tom Frawley's office, the basement stretches away. Garage areas, storage rooms, receiving rooms. And among the personnel, an occasional blue-uniformed guard. There are 127 of them in and around the building. And they keep an eye on the security of these six city blocks of international territory. These men are no ordinary guards, for their duty sometimes takes them half the world away from their homes and families. And when they accompany UN personnel to danger spots like Palestine and Korea, they risk their lives just as surely as soldiers in the field. But here are two guards from Latin America, not too far away from home, to have lost the sense of romance that we've come to expect from that part of the world. Rafael Campo from Buenos Aires.
Oh, I come from Argentina, yes, from La Pampa. It's in the middle of Argentina. This is the land of the gauchos and paisanos with guitarras. It's a very romantic country, special for love.
And Claudio Lima of Fortaleza, Brazil, who has been training to go abroad on a mission.
Probably they'll send me to Korea or to Palestine. That's what my supervisor told me today. So I'm almost in preparation to go out.
On his way to Korea on UN duty. Is he married?
No, I'm a single man. I'm 20 years old, and I didn't get married yet. I don't know why. I'm expecting someday I will.
We ring for the elevator. And go up to the first basement where we descend a ramp. Turn a corner and hear, of all things, unexpectedly, the sound of music. It comes from one of the three film cutting rooms, part of the motion picture division of the UN. We return to the corridor, past a machine shop, and come upon the only United Nations post office in the world. We don't bother with an elevator this time. Not when we can board a chromed and shining escalator, and the galloping staircase quickly carries us up to the level of the main lobby. Here, for the first and only time in this building, we encounter a floor with makeup on it. Green and white marble columns down the length of the lobby. The flooring, a checkerboard of black and white stone squares. It's handsome in an austere way, though to remind workers and visitors alike that this is the official headquarters of the greatest attempt to set the world straight since the first aggressive tribe attacked its neighbor. Perhaps this calm and dignified lobby is the focal point of the building, is almost as great a symbol of the organization as the UN's flag itself. In any case, the lobby is busy, and it is a simple matter to eavesdrop upon one of the day's hundreds of visitors directing queries at Miss Otterly Hayes of Flushing, Long Island, at the information desk.
How about Mr. David Owen?
Is he expecting us, sir?
No, he never heard of me.
Could you tell me what it's about, please?
It's about this new 10-nation cartel committee that's being set up, and they told me down at the U.S. mission that David Owen was a guy that was going to set it up. He's economic assistant to Mr. Trigby Lee, as near as I can identify him. Also said to be a very nice young Englishman. Some Englishmen are nice.
From the lobby here on up to the roof, the floors, with very few exceptions, look pretty much alike. But the people in them and the work they do are as varied as you would expect in a building devoted to the affairs of the whole planet. On the second floor are press and news bureaus, and the New York office, headquarters in Geneva, of ILO, International Labor Organization, one of 11 specialized agencies attached to the UN. You'll meet some of the others higher up. Right now, the Director General of ILO, David Morse, of Somerville, New Jersey, is on his way up to the third floor for a press conference. We follow him there. He gives a brief talk to the press and afterwards answers questions from reporters.
Are there enough receiving countries that would provide you with 4 million new places for people to live?
No. There are sufficient countries who have the available potential to absorb these people. But part of the problem in absorption will be housing.
I would like to repeat a question that Mr. Kiss has already put to be sure that I understood well. With your 5-year plan about the financing and so on, you are sure that there are...
On the fourth floor are newspaper offices with most of the world's greatest newspapers and wire services represented. Over at one end of the building, a bank. But in a strategic area on this floor stands a man ready at all times to help secretariat members put their best feet forward. James Rinaldi of Brooklyn. Shoeshine man by appointment to the UN. And here he is calling his trade to passing members of the secretariat.
Rinkius about the Skupusmi, Vaxi, Chirisov, Alamel Gazma, Boya, Engrashat, Lamel Gazma.
Is that Shoeshine?
That's right.
Okay, give me a shine.
Yeah, listen here, sir.
How many languages is there you're talking in?
Well, I usually say shoeshine in about 23 languages, 25 languages.
No kidding.
That's right, sir.
Very gosh, say. I didn't know there were that many languages spoken at UN.
Well, I have to learn how to say shoeshine in these different languages. People really think it was nice of me to say it in French and Spanish and so forth, being an international organization. And my clients taught me, and I recognize some of my customers, and I try to speak in their native tongue whenever I can recall where they're from, what parts of the world.
Jim is stationed at the foot of a broad staircase which climbs to the fifth floor. On 5 is a temporary cafeteria, a permanent health clinic, a co-op, and a credit union. And on the floor above, between a lost and found room and guard headquarters, is the busy office of Philippe Le Comte de Nuit of Paris. Monsieur de Nuit of the internship program and training courses for new staff members starts to explain how interns are selected by their home governments for duty here, but he's interrupted.
Excuse me just a minute. Training? Yes, speaking. Why, certainly. Sancho Varias, he came from the Philippines. He was assigned to the budget and finance. And finally, he got a fellowship, I think, at Yale, where he's now for a year. Not at all. Roger. Sorry.
He goes on to explain his job. On what basis, we ask him, are interns chosen?
On their background, on the account of their interest in the field of international affairs, they will eventually be assigned to a particular section where they fit. Now, we've had so far about 500 interns representing the 60 countries. The age is between 20 up to 35. These people work here in every department as any other staff member. They get a fellowship for that work, and every day they attend a series of lectures by top-ranking members of the secretariat. They've had Dr. Bunch as a speaker. They've had Mrs. Roosevelt, an extra speaker, outside speaker. They have regularly Mr. Cohen from Chile, who is the... this seems like a joke. I'm sorry. Training, yes. Speaking. The orientation will take place on...
He has a busy wire, does Monsieur de Nuit. And sometimes he has to answer curious questions. Here's a call that came in a moment later.
Training, yes. Speaking. No, it has nothing to do with medical students. No, interns is a... No, it's nothing to do.
Hundreds of questions pour into this building daily. And on the next floor up, the seventh, is a room in which six girls sit behind telephone turrets with rotary files at their sides and do nothing but cope with these questions. Two of the girls are Chinese, one American, one Canadian, and one Belgian. The latter is Manuela Horonic, born in Tanganyika, Africa, and she knows her secretariat building inside out.
Hello, yes? The relationship between World Health Organization and UN... Well, it's quite easy. The World Health is a specialized agency of the United Nations. Did you get that? That's all there is to it, yes. That's right. That's the same thing as UNESCO. Well, the exact legal implication of it, I don't have exactly. It's considered as a specialized agency of the UN, but...
On the eighth story, as we climb up out of this information, is United Nations Radio. Through these portals pass occasional programs such as the one you're listening to. But the main day-in and day-out service is by shortwave, the transmission of news in many languages by many people, around the clock, beaming the living history of the United Nations to hundreds of millions in the world around.
Husni al-Hadidi, Cairo, Egypt, broadcast in Arabic to Middle East countries. Huna al-Umam al-Muttahid.
Guillermo Caram, Tucumán, Argentina. I broadcast in Spanish to Latin America and Caribbean region. Hablan las Naciones Unidas.
Mary Vucetic, Zagreb, Yugoslavia, broadcasting in Serbo-Croat. Slušajte vijesti u jedinim...
José Roberto Díaz Lemi, São Paulo, Brazil. Portuguese broadcast to Brazil. Estas são as Nações Unidas.
Matai, Rangoon, Burma, broadcast to Burma in Burmese. Kaba kulatamega, Sangue Tanama.
Jacques Donneau, Paris, broadcasting to France. Ici les Nations Unies qui vous parlent de New York.
Mohamed Rashti, Yaz, Iran, broadcast in Persian. In Jos, Azamoni.
Dimitris Ioannopoulos, Athens, Greece, broadcast to Greece. Edo Inomena Ethni.
Claudia Cruz, Manila, Philippines, broadcast to the Philippines.
Meir Dresdner, Haifa, Israel, broadcasting in Hebrew. Kanha Umotamuchad.
Orhan Arzdemir of Izmir, Turkey, broadcast to Turkey.
From the spoken word on the eighth floor to the written word on the ninth, the press and publication section. Words, documents, transcripts for all the media of print. And pictures, too. On this floor are the official photographers of the United Nations. One of them is Maria Borde of Moscow, USSR.
I photograph all activities and events connected with the United Nations, meetings, delegations, visitors, and so on.
We ask what she does when she comes to work in the morning.
I look on my assignment cards. I run out on assignments, I come back, I develop my film, I write captions, I go back on assignments and go all day long. It depends what there is going on.
Any particular kind of work she prefers?
I usually specialize in bringing the opposite parties together. For instance, India and Pakistan, I ask them to shake hands for me and they say next moment she will ask us to kiss each other. Or Atchison and Wyszynski, Indonesia, and Dutch, and many others.
Just down the hall from Miss Bordy is the motion picture division, out of which come movies showing the work of the UN in various countries, particularly these days, pictures of the relief and rehabilitation done by the UN mission in Korea. Some of the films are shown in big theaters like the Roxy in New York and the Empire in London. But not all exhibitors know yet how or where such films can be obtained, and so the director of the department, Jan Lindström of Sweden, and his deputy, Maurice Liu of China, volunteer some friendly information to all interested parties.
If there happens to be an exhibitor listening to this program, I think I would like to advise you to do the following. You just write a letter to the Department of Public Information, United Nations Headquarters, New York City. That's all, and we'll be very glad to get in touch with you, and I'm quite sure that you will get something out of this.
In addition to that, Jan, we could say that our films are available to schools, universities, particularly those universities that have film extension services.
The second voice was that of Maurice Liu, one of eight Chinese named Liu who work in this building. On the floor above this section are the offices of one of the organization's eight assistant secretaries general, Benjamin Cohen of Chile. And from a land 12,000 miles straight across the Pacific from Chile comes another tenant on this floor, Robert Staines of Sydney, Australia. Mr. Staines, like everybody else here, has his work cut out for him. and you have to respect the round numbers that he uses so casually.
Our work is with the 700 million students in schools and colleges of the 60 member countries. Our task is to take through to these pupils and students in all those schools and colleges the story of what the United Nations is doing, the theory and the basis and the philosophy on which it rests, and the record of its achievements over the first few years of its life.
On the 11th floor is Miss Sylvia Mullins of St. Edelian, Cornwall, England. She works in the travel section and takes care of accommodations for secretariat members who move about on missions. Most of her work is transacted on the telephone, and sometimes one wonders how she can keep a straight face. Here she is talking to somebody bound for the Paris Assembly.
Hello? Yes? Oh, yes. 1,300 francs. That's right. That's... Oh, no, I'm afraid you've misunderstood it. 1,300 francs is for the day, not for the month. Well, that's not very expensive, you know. It's about 350 to the dollar. You see, there's nothing in Paris for a month at 1,300. Not even paper to clean your face. 1,300 is the price that you are going to pay each day. And without a bath at that. No bath. Oh, you don't mind about the bath. But, of course, it would be very silly to think that you could pay 1,300 francs for a month, because wherever you go, you won't be able to find that. No, I can tell you haven't. Well, anyhow, thank you for calling, and I won't cancel it unless I hear from you. Goodbye.
Every going organization has to buy things, and the UN is no exception. Also, on the 11th floor sits Frederick Mapes of Glen Cove, Long Island. He's the High Chief World Shopper. Last year, he made a tour of 16 countries in Europe, Asia, and Africa looking for bargains.
We buy everything that the United Nations need. There are the routine things, the stationery, office supplies, janitor supplies, maintenance equipment for the headquarters buildings, and then some of the unusual things which come up from time to time, such as buying the equipment for the General Assembly building. For instance, the chairs that the public and the delegates will sit on in the General Assembly building were bought in Sweden. The carpets on the floor that they walk on were bought in Holland, and the limestone that's on the face of the Secretariat building was bought in England. Many of the other things were bought in many other countries.
Documents are one of the important byproducts of the UN. And the Secretariat building is the assembly line that takes the raw material of history and fashions it into something that posterity, or even you, may consult at any time. On the 12th floor in the Bureau of Documents, we find Miss Helen Geffen of New York City toiling away over a very complicated matter indeed. Nobody in the world could explain it better than she.
All right, I'm on paragraph 4. Now let's see what happens. Actually, I can condense this. I have about 2.5 pages of notes on it, but it will all boil down into about 2 paragraphs, because most of the drafting suggestions, changes that were made, were later thrown out. They were not retained. And my summary just has to include what was finally decided. Now, let's see. Mr. Nizo spoke 4 times, but he said just about the same thing. I can squeeze all of that together in one. Here we are, Mr. Nizo, Belgium. Oh, let's see, what is the gist of that? He doesn't want to make any changes. He wants to leave it as it stands, so that's what we'll say. Wish to retain the paragraph with its present wording. Let's see. That's all he said, I think. Okay, through with him. Now.
Floor 13 is where 152 men and women type documents in Spanish, Russian, English, and French. And on the 14th floor, along with Russian and Spanish translation sections, is the UN Postal Administration. 15th floor, documents control, editorial control, production control. Very specialized, very complicated. But the complications are part of the process of simplifying. Mr. H. Granville Fletcher of Newcastle-on-Tyne, England, explains editing control.
The editing control consists of going through the paper or the document in the raw manuscript for style, for length, consistency, continuity, And in order to make sure that the one big thing which shouldn't happen, that is repetition, doesn't exist, we don't touch the substance of it, of the document, naturally, because we're not experts, as they have in the substantive departments, but we are very much involved in the substance where it affects both the style, the length, and the continuity.
16th floor, air conditioning, storage, and Jim Ferrara of Flushing, Long Island. Mr. Ferrara is the UN's expert on sign language. He paints signs, writes them, draws them. Nameplates, numbers, anything in the way of a sign, that's for Jim.
I paint signs in all kinds of languages. For instance, like Hebrew, Afghanistan, Russian, and other foreign signs. We also make these hand-painted signs which you would find out through the building. For instance, ladies in English and dames in French. Without signs, it would be just a state of confusion.
We're getting into the upper realms of art now, and on the 17th floor is the art and map department. Goes by the impressive title of the presentation unit of the publishing division. Henry Pollock of Cape Town, South Africa, looks up from a conference with Hector Ortiz of Montevideo, Uruguay, Fazal Karis of Lahore, Pakistan, and Leo Drozdov, New York City, and gives us an inkling of the problems of map-making, which is one of the main functions of this department.
I'm working now on phonetic spellings, which is one important phase in map-making. In my case, I'm working on Sumatra, which, as everybody knows, has become now independent, and formerly the spellings have been rendered in Dutch, and now, since we're making here a map in English, we will have to change all the Dutch spellings into English. For instance, one can see in the newspapers nowadays that Batavia has become Jakarta. Apart from that, lots of other names have been changed, which were too Dutch, and of course the Indonesians don't see the necessity of having Dutch names.
Floor 18 is given over to storage space for furniture and equipment. And 19 is storage also, but of a different kind. Archives. Not only everything that's happened since UN got going, but old League of Nations archives too. And Mr. Pernandu Basu of Lucknow, India, explains to us just how valuable only one phase of these records can be. It seems that when UNRWA, the old United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, was in operation, some of the shipping companies accidentally overcharged for their services.
So very often the shipping companies charged the UNRWA more than they should have for the cargo they carried to various places. And going over those records, we have been able to find that, exactly identify those cases, and reclaim that money, and the United Nations has got about $1 million out of that, which has all gone to the Children's Emergency Fund, which I think is very good.
All sorts of records, all here on this floor.
Yes, we have some which are not quite strictly official records, but they record various interesting occasions, like the anniversary program, which is a special program commemorating the adoption of the Declaration of Human Rights, which has got a speech by Sir Laurence Olivier and then music, things like that. Would you like to hear that?
We say yes, indeed.
Whereas, recognition of the inherent dignity of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights...
Well, as we said earlier, the one incontestable advantage that the Secretariat building has over that ancient skyscraper at Babel is a fine system of simultaneous interpretation. On the 20th floor in a conference room, one of the UN staff of official interpreters, Polish-born George Sherry of New York City, sums it up in a word.
First of all, of course, I should like to make clear that there are about 60 to 70 interpreters at the United Nations, and all these people have the job of seeing to it that the delegates understand each other, and that the public understands the delegates.
Then he proceeds to demonstrate simultaneous interpretation against a recording of Henri Spaak of Belgium. This is the way interpretation is done every day in almost all UN meetings. Only instead of one translation available to the audience, five are going on at the same time, into English, French, Spanish, Russian, and Chinese. Here is Mr. Sherry taking us from French to English.
Est-ce que mon discours est un discours
pessimiste?
Is my speech
perdu?
Do I consider that everything is
certainement
lost?
Certainement non.
Certainly not.
Gardant tout ce qui a été dit à cette tribune,
in everything that was said at this rostrum, I found that after all, whatever may be the different sense given to words in a certain manner of meaning, and so on and so forth.
Amidships on the 20th floor is what is probably the highest placed barber shop in the world. Certainly the one with the best view of the city's skyline. The shop is run by the brothers Barbagallo, an apt name for a barber, Barbagallo. And here they are caught in a routine conversation with two customers, an American and a South African. You won't have any trouble distinguishing who is who.
We can tell right away what kind of a haircut they want. See?
How can you tell?
On the way they've been cut before, because when they come in here after a week or 10 days or 2 weeks, you can easily tell if it was cut short or long. That's the only way you can tell, and we try to please them.
Supposing it was cut wrong the first time?
Well, then you adjust them. You adjust them. We have such a case that they get a haircut over here, and the wife was very pleased. And then they got a haircut other place, and then the wife has sent them back to the United Nations to be readjusted. That's right. That's a fact.
Inevitably, they get around to discussing various national preferences in haircuts and other customs.
Some nation nowadays, they like it shorter than others.
Englishmen, as a rule, wear their hair long at the sides. Frenchmen, long at the sides and on the top, and short at the back. And Americans, as a rule, have it cut short all over. In fact, some Americans prefer to have a crew cut.
Tell me, how do UN people tip in comparison with your other experience?
Well, more or less, to see some good ones and some fair, you know, you like in the city. The world is one.
Nothing makes the world one more quickly than telecommunications. And that department you find on the 21st floor. Also here is the office of Georges Mathieu of Paris, Bureau of Documents. We get to talking about statistics, and he has some fascinating ones for us.
We have many computations. The Secretariat is very fond of statistics. One of the most impressive figures was calculated right at the beginning, that 1 hour of speech gives rise to 327 hours of work afterwards. This year we had an examination for French translators. We had about 3,500 people who applied, both here and in France, Belgium, Switzerland, etc. Out of these, we had a screening, and that left us with about 700. Out of the 700, 550 turned up for the examination. Out of those, we had about 13 fairly well-qualified people who emerged at the end.
Staggering under this statistic, we take the elevator to the next floor, the 22nd, and are immediately hit by initials at every turn. IBRD, FAO, IMF, WHO, and UNESCO. IBRD stands for International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. IMF, International Monetary Fund. UNESCO, of course, the UN's Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. WHO you meet directly in the person of Mrs. Sylvia Marr, New York City, liaison officer of the World Health Organization. She starts to tell you about the organization, and you realize it's a program by itself. But on a quick tour of the building like this one, you can just get the barest sense of what goes on. It's almost like going through the Louvre on a bicycle. What has WHO done? Well, stopped cholera epidemic in Egypt, controlled typhus in Afghanistan, treated 100,000 people for yaws in Thailand and Indonesia, insect control campaign, Latin America, malaria in Greece reduced by 75%, influenza center in London, and so on and on, something new every day.
For example, yesterday, Dr. Abraham Stone's travel was arranged, New York to Geneva to New Delhi. He's going to New Delhi to do a special assignment for the World Health Organization in family planning. This is at the request of the government of India, which is interested in possibilities of population control.
If WHO is doctor to the world, FAO is farm expert. Alicia Baños of Mexico City says the Romans had a word for it.
FAO can best be described by its motto. Motto in Latin is fiat panis. It means let there be bread. We in FAO really feel it extends beyond that, though. It really means in everyday living, better housing, a better way of life.
She gives examples of how this remarkable organization is helping nations to raise their standards of living by better methods of farming and fishing, forestry, care of animals. Just one of the many projects in the field of nutrition, for instance.
Not long ago, we had a technician in Africa who had been looking into a disease that kills so many babies there. In fact, he worked with one particular tribe trying to find what was killing these babies. And they finally, together with a World Health Organization man, pinned the killer down to a disease with a very unpronounceable name, kwashiorkor. It really means red boy, because part of the disease, this Negro child, begins to change. The skin becomes first yellowish, then red. Well, our technician discovered that it was due to a simple deficiency in the food. And if you just gave it the right food or the right amount of this missing element, the baby lived.
Next floor up is used just for storage. But on the floor above, the 24th, is the New York office of the International Children's Emergency Fund. This agency, called UNICEF by all who know and love it, helps 64 countries of this overburdened world take better care of their children. Medical aid, clothing, food for emergency needs, school feeding programs, all sorts of things. On the wall of the UNICEF office of Mrs. Dolores Vogler, a New Yorker, are spread photographs illustrating some of the phases of UNICEF's work. Mrs. Vogler gets up from her desk to show them to us.
Well, at the top there, you have a little Japanese girl wearing the very dress that the Japanese made. Down to the right there is a little Greek boy making shoes from UNICEF's leather. And on the left here is a little girl in Greece receiving the shoes. And those darlings up there are two little Guatemalan girls. They are drinking milk in the classroom. You notice the books and the pencils and other things there that indicate the class. And, oh, well, this happy chap holding the blanket and the soap from UNICEF lives in a village called Skathi in Greece. He seems very pleased, doesn't he? Oh, and this little girl, oh, that is little Zora Mohamud. That is Pakistan, and she is being inoculated against tuberculosis. She doesn't seem to like it very much, but it will protect her against TB for 3 years. By the way, she was the 15 millionth child to be tested for TB by UNICEF and World Health Organization teams in Pakistan. That's the Middle East, and that those three pictures give you something of a view of our operations there. Down the bottom, you see a group of Jewish children, immigrants in a school in Israel, receiving some milk and margarine to go with the rather slim meal that they get there. You know, Israel's had about 100,000 immigrants in the last 4 months, and they have quite a problem.
So far, 60 million kids have benefited, and that's a lot of humanity.
And by the way, you know, the children we help have had a large part to play in keeping the spirit of UNICEF alive. Just to show you what I mean, here's a recording of a song made up by a group of Yugoslavian school children. It's their way of saying thank you.
On the 25th floor, the password is technical assistance. Assistance to countries that need help in any field where the United Nations, by getting experts to work on their problems, can lend a hand. Here is Willem Brand of Amsterdam, the Netherlands, telling us something about the area with which he is concerned, the Far East.
We are helping the government of Ceylon on beach minerals. We sent an expert who is trying to find out if this is a feasible project to explore and to exploit beach minerals, which Ceylon has. We are also trying to find an expert for that country on kaolin exploration and refining. We are trying for that same country again to find an iron and steel expert because they want to set up the electric iron smelting plant. For other countries, for India, for example, we are trying to find an expert on prefabricated housing. For Thailand, we are sending out an expert in the social welfare field. there is to be set up.
From Mr. Brand's Amsterdam to Tehran is 4,000 miles as a crow flies, but men of both cities are just a few feet apart on the 25th floor. Dr. Taghi Nasr of Iran tells us something of the scope of technical assistance, a phase of UN activity that is growing rapidly and which, once war and the threat of war are out of the way, would undoubtedly be epic in its proportions and its accomplishments.
Some 60 countries have asked for technical assistance, and we have assisted more than 50 of them so far.
There's a canteen on the 26th floor at which we refuel on coffee, and from there we move along to a wing named Division of Economic Stability and Development. 27, and we're getting up there. More technical assistance here. And something else. Dorothy Kahn of Seattle, Washington, tells us of a single phase of the social welfare service program that is guided from this floor.
We have a small staff of people. One of them happens to be a totally blind man himself. He is concerned primarily with the activities for the blind and the visually handicapped. We are now setting up a demonstration project in Yugoslavia for the physically handicapped. Our whole idea is to help people to help themselves.
28 is another floor that the elevator usually whisks by. Storage again. But on the 29th is where NGO, for non-governmental organizations, hangs its official hat. Groups like social and humanitarian bodies that want to be heard by the UN have a direct pipeline. Tender of the pipeline is Lyman C. White of Bradford, Pennsylvania.
I think this is an answer to people who say that there is nothing that they can do. In fact, the channel is open to every individual who really wants to make an effort to get his ideas accepted through his own organization and have them brought up for action by the United Nations.
We're on the 30th floor now, and here we find Ricardo Luna of Lima, Peru, who recently spent 8 months in Paraguay helping that country organize and take its first national census of population. We ask him whether he finds statistics dry and unemotional, and we get a hint of the story behind his figures from his simple answer.
No, sir, I don't think it is lacking emotion or humanity. It may be so for people who are not in this field or are not familiar with the techniques of statistics.
31, Human Rights Division. Another program all by itself. But among the deep-reaching fundamental rights that the United Nations is working to achieve for all nations are women's rights. And Madame Sophie Grinberg-Vinever of Paris, former lawyer, tells us a little about the status of women in this man's world.
Since the Charter of the United Nations has been signed in 1945, 23 countries have granted women either full or partial political rights. And we like to think, and I hope we are right in thinking, that the United Nations has contributed to this advance in a very, very considerable extent. Since last year, for example, two countries have granted women rights, El Salvador and Haiti. A movement is on its way now in Lebanon, and Syria has granted rights to women in 1950. We are very much encouraged by this effort, but we think that it should be even more generalized, because there are still some 15 or 16 countries where women have no rights. And that's why the Commission has, at its last session, adopted a decision to have an international treaty giving women equal political rights throughout the world.
On 32 is the Narcotic Drugs Division. Since the menace of illicit drug traffic is international, it takes an international organization to battle it. One of the frontline battlers is Charles Fulton of Fairfield, Iowa, a scientist specializing in methods of tracing contraband to its source.
Well, my work that's aroused so much interest is work in developing methods for determining the origin of seized opium in order to show what countries are responsible for allowing it to escape from control and provide illicit drugs for the world.
On 33 is a man from a land almost as far away as it is possible to get from New York, the Gold Coast of British West Africa. He is Daniel Chapman, graduate of Oxford, an area specialist in the trusteeship division.
On this floor, you'll be hearing about the people of the non-self-governing territories, including those under trusteeship. You have about 7 territories in Africa and 4 territories in the Pacific, which are directly administered under the supervision of the United Nations. By the way, you're right in time to listen to the record I'm just going to put on. It is about the welcome given to the United Nations visiting mission when they went to the Cameroons. The spokesman of the Bekwere people says, "We welcome you to our country. We are not rich people, but we'll do our best to make you feel at home among us." You will hear him say this, followed by a ceremonial song by the Bekwere.
Yende bamu, lo awe ninyo, iloke na nema yo jafe ulongo ekumeyasu.
On the same floor is a famous UN figure, grandson of a Negro slave who became a war stopper, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and one of the foremost world citizens of our time, Dr. Ralph Bunche of New York City. And in his modest book-lined office, he tells us something of what his work involves.
This department is directly concerned with the present and future well-being of some 200 million non-self-governing, or more popularly, colonial peoples, involving about 75 territories. Colonialism is one of the prime factors in generating wars. There can be no secure foundations for peace or for freedom in the world so long as a substantial part of the world's population is not free and is subject to attack by aggressor-minded peoples or nations. For example, if we consider the period since the end of the last war, most of the threats to the peace have occurred in colonial territories or in territories which were only recently freed from colonial rule. Indonesia, Indochina, Palestine, Korea, Malaya are cases in point.
The 34th floor is divided between legal affairs and the Atomic Energy Group of the UN. The atom and its subdivisions are, to say the least, a matter of pressing concern to the whole world. And this is the department in the UN which at the moment is wrestling with the problem. Dr. Otto Frey of Prague, Czechoslovakia, has been at this work for the past 5 years. As chief of the UN group, he tells us,
"We all hope that to preserve peace and to limit armaments will help to make more man and more energy and material available to push the peaceful uses forward rather than devote them to the production of weapons. It's a question of confidence if we are in a position to control atomic energy, we shall have made the world more secure to deal with the problems of technical assistance, development of underdeveloped countries. That general atmosphere of confidence will gain if UN can be successful in the sphere of atomic energy."
On the 35th floor is the Department of Security Council Affairs, and the fact that it is above the Atomic Energy Group is perhaps symbolic. On the 36th floor, we meet again the man whom we overheard in the barbershop discussing haircuts. He's William Duke of Johannesburg, South Africa, who specializes in recruiting field service people for the UN's Department of Personnel. Through our talk, he is interrupted by the press of business.
Hello. Yes, too. Yes, he is due in next week. Yes, but have you got a mission to send him to? Which one? Korea? Yes. Well, then you'll give him his indoctrination course at headquarters, which will take 3 months, and then send him to Korea. Okay. And what about the Iraqi who left today? To Greece? Yes. So who will you be sending to Somaliland? Contreras, Guatemalan. Yes. Yes. All right. Goodbye.
What the UN looks for in people is explained to us by Mr. Duke's neighbor on this floor, Naomi Osborne of Mount Carmel, Indiana. Personnel officer.
Of course, in an organization such as the United Nations, it's very important that we get not only technically qualified persons, but people free from prejudices regarding race, religion, and color. It's very essential that our people believe in the principles as set forth in the United Nations Charter in human rights.
On this same 36th floor, a little to the north of Miss Osborne's office, is the home of the Staff Pensions Committee, whose secretary is David Bannerman Clark of Kilmarnock, Ayrshire, Scotland. He greets us, moves over with us to one of the building's 5,400 bluish-green windows, and looks out on the tidal strait that New Yorkers call the East River, the strip of swift-moving ocean water that separates Manhattan from Long Island.
Here we are, looking right down on the East River, always filled with small craft. Here you've got these little tugs there. These captains are very clever fellows. You see them with a 1,000-ton train on each side of them, nosing their way into a very narrow bit of a harbour. And I've seen a few trawlers racing each other coming down from the Sound with their fish to catch the early market. Well, now, suppose we talk about the job for a bit. My job here is the social security of the staff. And the biggest thing in it is a big pension fund. It's a job that is definitely on the sidelines, if you like, but we see a good deal of the game. I often drop into the Security Council. I can't help feeling that it's a pity they can't run the political side as well as, or rather as easy as I run my pension fund. It's a more difficult sort of line, of course. But as I listen, I can't help wondering often whether it is that man's brain isn't clever enough or that his heart isn't clean enough, that he just doesn't seem to be able to keep control of his own destiny. When it comes to the sort of questions that I have to deal with, the begetting of children, sickness, old age and death, none of the curtains seem to make much difference then. People are apt to think that pension work is rather dull work, but it's very far from that. It's as broad as life. I remember once in the Paris Assembly when we thought we had the regulations for the pension fund all sewn up, nice and tight. I was knocked for a loop by a Mohammedan gentleman who stood up and asked me if we had made any provisions for the followers of his faith who probably leave more than one widow. Well, believe me, the best I could say in reply to that was that if he would put me in touch with a learned doctor of his faith, we would do the very best we could to arrange things in accordance with their traditions. I remember once when I had a bit of trouble with the chief of the budget here. He told me that I had estimated for far more children than there really were in the families of the secretary. I said, well, it's probably a good deal your fault on the budget side. If the people had a bit more security and a bit more money, the babies would come along all right. I said, in any case, it was a situation which could change overnight. And he didn't seem to have another one to say.
On the 37th floor is the cashier's office, Bureau of Accounts and Treasury. The clock does not permit us to stop here, so we keep on the elevator to the 38th and top floor. Here it is carpeted and bright. A broad reception hall looks out over the landscape, and from its windows on a clear day, you can see 100 or 200 square miles of the fabulous New York metropolitan area. At the south end of the floor is the office of the President of the General Assembly. At the north end, the office of the top man of the whole Secretariat, Trygve Lie of Oslo, Norway. His office is paneled, appropriately, in Norwegian pine, a great bronze head of a famous world citizen, Benjamin Franklin, stands on a mantelpiece. Mr. Lie, who has been the UN's Secretary General from its birth, receives us. We tell him about our tour of this building and ask him whether, sometime when he finds a minute, he'd be good enough to write a statement to round out the broadcast. He ponders for a moment, then calls for a secretary and dictates a statement. He dictates smoothly and quickly, knowing exactly what he wants to say from the outset.
The Secretariat building is like a great living switchboard, bringing the world together as it never has been brought together in the past. This structure has been called the Workshop for Peace. It is that, and more. And although the keeping of peace is now, and always will be, the most important of all assignments, it is still only one of the tasks to which the United Nations organization is dedicated. There is no other building on the face of the earth where more people from more different nations work daily at a greater variety of jobs. And in terms of the things they accomplish and the significance of these accomplishments to vast numbers of people, this building of steel and glass and marble is unique in all history. For practically everything that is done by each of those working here contributes in some way to the ultimate goal of freedom and security for all the peoples in the world.
He asked us whether that would be all right. We say, yes, indeed. From Mr. Lee's office to the roof is a climb up a broad flight of stairs. We step out onto the windy roof. It's a clear day. We can look to the horizon on all four compass points. From far below comes the sound of construction, ships around the river, plying the commerce of peace. War and the rumor of war seem distant and theoretical at this height. We have climbed quickly from the bottom basement to the roof, and have talked all too briefly to all too few of the personnel in this building. But the one big impression that we'll carry away from this glass cliff is that everybody in this community, from Cookie the truck driver to Mr. Lee, is working hard in his or her way to keep war and the rumor of war distant and theoretical. More than that, everybody's working for the tangible goals of bread, good health, human rights, security, and freedom. Strung together as words, they sound a little worn from hard use in so many speeches. But to the Secretariat of the UN, as well as to the world at large, they have a living, vital, urgent, day-to-day meaning, and they are things to be worked for. In fact, work is the motto, and Mr. Cook was right when he said to us way back there,
when you come here, you get a job, hey, you work. You work all the time. These fellows, every one of them, you see them here now, they're all working. You have to work.
Debating society, pipe dream, utopian vision, false hope, impractical, purposeless? Not to these people. They know debate is a far better alternative than war. They know that history is a series of dreams come true. They're not afraid of setting their sights high and not ashamed of hope. As for practicality, what could be more sensible and realistic than a world functioning securely, profitably, systematically? And if you question purpose, ask the 2 billion people of this earth who, even as you and I and members of the Secretariat, look for things to be better all the way around. Better food, health, education, children, economy, peace. That's the UN's purpose. Here on the roof, the flag of the United Nations snaps in the breeze. We look at that flag for a long time. It's a handsome banner, blue, with a white emblem. In the center, an outspread map of the continents. It means the world to us.
You have been listening to Douglas Fairbanks as narrator and personnel of United Nations headquarters in Windows on the World, a special broadcast transcribed and produced by Norman Corwin of United Nations Radio to celebrate the opening in Paris this week of the 6th General Assembly of the United Nations. Assisting Mr. Corwin in the production were Helen Dunlop, Virginia Momond, Sylvia Scott, Jeff Sparks, and Stephen Temer. All voices heard on this program were authentic and unrehearsed. The musical score was by Lana Domian.